In the world of music, innovator is one of the most overused labels, but how else can you describe the career of seven-time Grammy-winning jazz vibraphonist Gary Burton? For over six decades, he's defied expectations. He began his career by recording with country musicians in Nashville, and then became one of the first jazz artists to incorporate rock music into his recordings and performances. He's taught for over 30 years at the Berklee College of Music in Boston, and in 1994, he came out on NPR, no less, as one of the few gay jazz musicians. In a new autobiography called Learning to Listen, The Jazz Journey of Gary Burton, he recounts performances, tours, and recording sessions with the likes of Stan Getz, Chick Corea, Pat Metheny, Roy Haynes. His band, the new Gary Burton Quartet, recently released a CD called Guided Tour, and they are currently engaged in a week-long run at the Blue Note in Greenwich Village. His book is published by Berklee Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought Gary Burton back to our show.
Yeah, nice to be here again.
Didn't Stan Getz tell you, don't call us, we'll call you, after you auditioned for him?
He did.
How old were you at the time?
I was 20 or 21, roughly. And the audition didn't go well. It was...
Was it your fault or his?
Both. It was at Basin Street East, a prominent club at the time, and he was playing there with his then current band, and his guitarist was soon to leave, and he was looking for a replacement, hadn't been able to find either a pianist or a guitarist available, and someone recommended me as a vibraphone player that maybe I could fill that role.
Because vibes often fill the role of a piano.
Yeah, I play with four mallets and I can play chords and accompany in that sense. So I hauled my vibes down to the club to sit in with him, to give him an example of what my playing was like. But I didn't know their songs or their arrangements. And the guitar player at the time played very busily and kind of constantly, so I couldn't really find much room to show what I could do. And then Stan had a temper tantrum as well after about four songs. You know, I had only been accompanying a little bit behind the guitar player when he soloed, but not for Stan because there wasn't room to get in there. But Stan turned to me with a very angry red face and said, what's wrong with my playing? Why don't you accompany me? And that, you know, I was in shock the rest of the set, so I couldn't play very well. And at the end of the whole thing, he said, well, don't call us, we'll call you. But he did call me, after all.
Later, a biographer once wrote that he was a mean-spirited man who played the most beautiful music.
That's a great description. You know, he was what probably today would be diagnosed as bipolar. He would be either super nice, warm, and friendly, and then the next day angry, paranoid, and mean to everybody, and thinking everyone was out to take advantage of him. And you never knew which Stan you were going to be dealing with.
Well, how is it that you did wind up playing with him? After all, by then, I assume you had established your reputation and he no longer was felt it was necessary for you to audition.
No, well, it actually happened a week later. He still hadn't found anyone to go on this the first tour he had coming up, 3 weeks in Canada. So too embarrassed to call me himself, he had the bass player, who was a friend of mine, call me up and say, look, Stan still needs somebody, and he wants you to do this 3 weeks until he has time to find someone else. So I reluctantly accepted because I could use the work, and the other guys in the band were people I knew. So I said, well, how bad can it be?
Well, you could rehearse, couldn't you?
Well, we had one rehearsal the day before we left for Canada. And turned out he didn't have any music to show me. He wanted to play tunes that he played records for me, and I would have to learn them off the record while we were standing there. It was pretty loose. But the first week didn't go very well. The second and third week, I began to kind of figure out how to play with him, and we had kind of a group sound and blend by the end of the 3 weeks, and he asked me to stay on for a while longer, and that eventually became 3 years.
Which is a long time with Stan Getz. He had problems with a lot of people. I mean, he became really, had a huge hit with Astrid Gilberto. Yeah. Were you in the group at that time?
I was in the group. They recorded that record,
The Girl from Ipanema,
and the album called Gets Gilberto, about 2 months before I joined the band. So I was with the group when the record was released and shot to the top of the charts, not even just the jazz charts, but the pop charts. It was the number two record that year, only bested by the Beatles, who had the top slot. And he did win the album of the year for that record in the Grammys. And so we worked literally 7 days a week, even not only six nights a week at clubs, but the seventh day would always be booked as an extra concert somewhere. It was pretty stressful, actually. But for me, as a newcomer, it was the best way possible to get in front of the audiences and get known and established.
But he did have a falling out with Astrid Gilberto.
Yeah, it was pretty wild. They had had a rocky affair during the 6 months or so that she toured with the band. And it all came apart when Astrid decided that she wasn't getting a proper royalty for the record. She wasn't supposed to be on the record. It was a last-minute thing. It was her husband who was, making the record with Stan, and she just sang this one song, and that's what ended up being the hit. So ultimately, she sued Stan and the record company for royalties, and so that just was the final straw. And if their affair wasn't enough of a problem, money eventually, brought it to an end.
Of the many strange gigs you had with Stan Getz, perhaps the most surreal was when you were playing for the King and Queen of Thailand and President Johnson and Lady Bird Johnson?
Yeah, someone in the president's office, I was one of the secretaries or something, was a big Stan Getz fan and had arranged for him to be invited to play at the White House two or three times.
And wasn't the King of Thailand a jazz fan or even a musician?
He was a saxophone player, or maybe still is, although he's pretty elderly at this point. But they asked him what entertainment would he like when President Johnson came for a state visit to Thailand in an upcoming tour. That was in 1966. And he answered either Benny Goodman or Stan Getz. So Stan got the call, and they flew us to Thailand. We were there about a week before President Johnson arrived, and we spent the whole week with the king. Every day, they would send cars over to bring us to the palace, and we would sit around and talk about the saxophone or have little jam sessions with some of his local musician friends. It was kind of magical.
My guess is Gary Burton, who's written are we going to call this a memoir, an autobiography, a musical memoir?
Either one, I guess.
It's called Learning to Listen, The Jazz Journey of Gary Burton. How did you wind up choosing the vibes to play? Isn't it rare for a kid to choose that over the saxophone, the trumpet, piano, drums?
Right. Well, kids normally choose what they see on television. That's why there's so many guitar players, drummers, singers, and some saxophone and so on. But I
did you see Red Norfo one day?
No, I didn't.
Milt
didn't.
Jackson?
My parents chose it, as it happened. I was 6 years old, and my parents wanted all three of us kids in the family to get music lessons. And my older sister already played the piano. So they looked around to see what else was available. And at 6 years old, I didn't know anything about music instruments. But there was a lady in that particular town where I lived at that age who played the marimba and the vibraphone and gave lessons. So that's where they took me. And that's how I got introduced to it. I thought there were vibraphone players everywhere until we moved to another part of the state of Indiana. And no one had ever heard of the thing. And I found that I was on my own from that time forward.
Well, it's a lot easier to carry a guitar or a trumpet or a saxophone. There's usually a piano at most
right.
locations, often drums.
Yeah.
Vibes, you got to bring your own.
That's right. And that's another one of the reasons I've always believed that there aren't as many vibists around as there are other instruments.
And how did you develop the technique of playing with four mallets instead of the usual two?
Well, that also relates to my growing up in rural Indiana. I lived in a small farm town. And I was the only musician or serious musician. So I played alone most of the time until I got into, up to the point where I could get a driver's license and go to other towns to find other musicians. And I wanted the music to sound more complete. I needed harmony. Just playing a single melody line didn't work for me. So I kept trying to make the four mallet playing work. And at the time, the conventional wisdom was four mallet playing is impractical. It'll never work. Don't waste time with it. But I didn't really know that, being on my own. And I developed a pretty solid four mallet technique by the time I was seriously working on my jazz skills.
Were your major influences pianists or other vibes players?
My favorite vibes player was Milt Jackson with the Modern Jazz Quartet. I don't play anything like him stylistically, but I always thought he was the best and the most fun to listen to.
He loved to hold these notes, sustain notes, for a long time.
And he was a two mallet player, which meant that my style was already so different that I wasn't likely to copy him much. But my big influences tended to be piano players. Bill Evans, in particular, as I got more into jazz, he was my hero.
As he is for pretty much all the piano players who followed him. When Miles Davis recorded with Thelonious Monk, didn't he insist that Monk lay out during his solos and that Milt Jackson actually comp behind him with the vibes?
I've never heard that, but it's quite possible. Miles was very particular about as some musicians are. Stan Getz was one also, very particular about how one accompanies him. And so I could imagine that being an issue.
And Miles was another person who could be unpleasant. Didn't he make a death threat?
He did. I had been misquoted in a newspaper interview in the Los Angeles Times, and it made it sound like I was critical of Miles, or that sort of made it sound like I had said he was old, out of date, and no longer an important player. Which I didn't say, but the writer kind of wrote it that way. And it turned out Miles happened to be in L.A. at the time and saw the paper. And a few days later was in San Francisco where I was playing in a club. And he came in to have lunch with the club owner, a friend of his. And when he saw that I was playing at the club, he, in a very harsh voice, said to the club owner, "Tell Gary Burton that if he uses my name, if she mentions my name again, I'll kill him."
Oh, boy.
So
did you ever patch it up?
Well, I tried. I didn't know what to do. The club owner said, "Well, quick, write him a note saying, it was a mistake and you apologize and hope things are okay and drop it off at his hotel," which I did. Never heard anything back. I crossed paths with Miles another dozen times at least over the years, on festivals and airplanes and things, traveling around. And I knew all the musicians in his band, played with quite a few of them in different settings. But he never spoke to me, and I was too intimidated to speak to him.
Well, one of the things that you had in common was that the both of you try to combine jazz and rock. I don't know who was the first to do that. There were a number of people who tried that fusion from both sides. Frank Zappa from the rock side,
right.
You and Miles, and
John McLaughlin was another with his Mahavishnu Orchestra. I started first in 67. Miles came along with this new direction in 69.
And what led you to think that was something you'd want to do? Because I'm sure all the jazz purists were horrified.
They were. Although, oddly enough, some of the older established jazz musicians were among the first to say it was fine with them. Monk became quite a fan of my band, for instance, and was always praising us for our songs and that sort of thing. But I was ready to start my own band. I was 24 years old. I was leaving Stan Getz. And I was thinking, what direction should I go? I want to stand out. I want to have a group that is different and people will notice. And a couple of observations I made. One was that Stan had a huge success blending Brazilian music, samba, with jazz. And I thought, well, you know, blending musics together, that's a great idea. What music do I like? And it was country music, as I had come up through Nashville. It was rock music. I had just discovered the Beatles and Bob Dylan and so on. And then I looked at the audiences that I was playing for with Stan and George Shearing, and they were all in their 40s and 50s, and I was 24. They were going to be gone by the time I was 40 and 50. So I also wanted to connect with my own generation. So that kind of pointed me in this direction.
And you played with a number of musicians who also were kindred spirits, like Chick Corea, who also spent a lot of time with Miles, Pat Metheny.
Mm-hmm.
Some musicians like to play with new people all the time. Others love the idea of developing a long-term relationship because you can really, you know just what you're going to get from that drummer, that guitarist, that saxophone player.
And I think musicians generally fall into either of those two categories. They either like the settled and established and predictable setting, or they like to be challenged and explore something different because they get bored easily. And I think I've actually straddled that. I've have a 40-year-old collaboration going with Chick and with Pat Metheny, and yet I still love discovering new young players like my new current guitar player, Julian Lodge, who's 25 years old and is a terrific talent and keeps me inspired night after night.
Well, you've called your book Learning to Listen, and playing jazz is so much about listening to the other musicians.
Yeah.
It's really a conversation, isn't it?
That's right.
Now, you came out as a gay man publicly, at least on Fresh Air.
Mm-hmm. I did.
Was this a surprise to other musicians, or had you come out earlier to them?
Well, I had come out to my own musicians, my closest friends, and my family, and some of my coworkers at Berkeley. But it was still pretty quiet. I always knew that someday, I predicted it would be a jazz writer at a newspaper or something, would, you know, get wind of this and ask me about it, and I would, of course, be prepared to talk about it. I didn't anticipate it being in an interview with Terry Gross on national radio. So it caught me off guard for a couple of seconds when she first asked the question, you've come out now, so how's that affecting your music and your career in jazz and so on? But we went ahead and talked about it for a half an hour on the show, and then I waited expecting I would get all kinds of letters about it.
Well, jazz is a rather macho world.
Yeah.
Lester Young was hurt by rumors that he might be gay in a previous generation or two.
So I wasn't sure what to expect, but, you know, I didn't get a single negative letter out of the many that did show up. They were all supportive and positive. And so I've been very lucky in that regard. Both my family and extended family have been very supportive, as well as my musical friends, my collaborators. If anything, my career has gone even better since I came out than it was before.
Fred Hirsch has also come out and also revealed that he's HIV positive.
That's right.
And hasn't hurt his career either.
No.
But you wonder if all of this had happened 30 years ago, what would it would have done to your career?
That's the thing. I had, signals when I was coming of age in high school that I had these feelings that I knew were unacceptable. And as I got, headed into a jazz career, it was painfully clear that this was just not something that was going to mesh with a career in jazz. And I literally suppressed it. I just wouldn't let myself think about it. I fought it every step of the way, and I convinced myself that I had some kind of extra aesthetic. After all, I was an artist and a musician, and I kind of had a rationale about what I thought that was going on. And it wasn't until my second marriage ended, and I was in my early 40s, and someone posed a question to me when I turned 40, which was very provocative. It says, "What do you plan to do for the second half of your life?" And I kept thinking about that. And the answer finally was, I want to fix anything that didn't go right in the first half. And that led me to this lifelong issue buried in the bottom of my brain. You know, what is going on with my sexuality?
You'll be playing at the Blue Note through this Sunday. By the way, listeners can find out about tickets on our show page at WNYC.org. Is the group on the new CD called Guided Tour the same as
yes.
the group that you're at the Blue Note
right.
with?
This is the group I've had for the past 3 years now, and very proud of them, very happy. It's our second CD, in fact, with the band. And we toured Europe already with the new music, and now we're touring the U.S. We're about halfway through this tour.
How much is a band like this responsible for, not just you, because you are the leader, you're the one who can choose all the material, but how much do you depend on the other musicians
well,
for the sounds,
sure.
for arrangements, and for the
right.
music?
Well, in this case, everybody in the band writes music and contributes, so our repertoire is pretty much equally divided among the four of us, so we all participate.
Gary Burton's autobiography is Learning to Listen, The Jazz Journey of Gary Burton. It's published by Berkeley Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure, Leonard. Thank you.